from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of the Actors Theater of Indiana's production of Godspell.
Turn back, oh man. I'll learn about the history of color film from restorationist Eric Grayson.
And then I'll chat with artist Justin Vining about a new show of his work at the Murphy Arts Center. Plus, we'll have our arts calendar we call...
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Actors Theatre of Indiana, or ATI, is the resident professional theater company at the Center for the Performing Arts. Beginning February 10th, ATI will present the rock musical Godspell, based on the Gospel according to St. Matthew, at the Studio Theater. Travis DiNicola spoke with ATI Artistic Director and cast member Judy Fitzgerald, ATI's new Executive Director James A. Riley, and Godspell Director Michael Dotson.
Judy, I'm going to start with you, ladies first. give me the quick background on what Actors Theater is and how it's working out in your new home up at the Center for the Performing Arts.
Well, Actors Theater of Indiana, we moved from New York. It was it was me and it was Don Farrell and Cynthia Collins, and we all moved in 2005 and started Actors Theater of Indiana, and we traveled from venue to venue to venue waiting for the Performing Arts Center in Carmel to open up. And finally, we opened last year with Chicago in our new home at the Studio Theater.
Yes.
Yay. And so now we're getting ready to have another big musical for Actors Theater of Indiana.
Godspell.
So awesome. We're very, very excited. We are the only resident professional theater company in the Center for the Performing Arts and in Hamilton County.
Which is a very cool thing. And last year you guys had tremendous reviews for Chicago.
Yes.
And which was great. And, you know, there was a lot of people wondering, well, how are they going to pull this off, especially in the Studio Theater, which is the smallest of the three theaters. It's not the Palladium. It's in the building sort of across the lawn that shares the building with the Tarkington. And it's a very, very cool sort of black box intimate theater. And everyone was just like, what a great production. What a great place to see it. So and so I know there's a lot of excitement about the tackling of Godspell by ATI.
We're very excited and very fortunate to have Michael Dotson here, who is here from L.A. to direct the show, one of our dear friends. And we've been in rehearsals, and it's just, I can't even express, it's just so exciting. And we have such a wonderful, talented group of people. And just like Chicago, the intimacy of that space, so many people are like, you feel like you're a part of the show. I mean, you're in it.
It's not the type of space for a musical, especially.
Oh, and for this, and what could be for this show? It's perfect because this is such an all-encompassing, embracing piece. I mean, I personally grew up with it. It was one of the first shows, actually, the first show I did when I was in North Central. I did community. I did it at Warren Central, and that was my first kind of outside of my. High school show.
So and it's one of those shows that even if people haven't seen it before, many people have a general idea what it's about. And of course, people have heard the song Day by Day. But Michael, let me talk about your interpretation of this. You've come to Indiana from California to direct Godspell in a small, funky theater up in Carmel. How's that working out for you?
It's amazing. I was lucky enough to do the Andrews Brothers last summer for ATI in that space.
Okay, very cool.
So yeah. It was great to be able to work there first, to really have a sense of where the walls are, if you will. We talked about it last summer, me coming back and directing Godspell. And I've done the I've been in the show twice, once in college, a very sort of spandex and crimp your hair post-apocalyptic Godspell. This won't be that, but it's very current. It takes place now, current day, and we're looking at the Gospel according to St. Matthew, it's sort of an updated interpretation of the show. So if you love the show,
update in terms of costumes, in terms of that it how takes, you're in the set.
I mean, yeah, that it takes place now.
Yeah,
We're placing it in a bar,
Okay.
So it adds, there's lots of different options as far as, you know, you can use, we're going to use some glow sticks and things like that. And and the band is really the band in the bar.
Because it's got kind of that, you know, that hippie 70s feel to it. Often is that, that's how it's interpreted, of course.
Exactly. I mean, that's, you know, it was originally done in the 70s. And it was created in by a company, if I remember right, in Chicago or somewhere, and it was just a group of actors that got together to put this thing together originally.
Okay.
So they weren't necessarily singers, all of them. And so it's really interesting now when the show is done, you cast all singers, and the music that you listen to on that original soundtrack is, and we all have that great fondness for it, but now when you hear it with real singers like Judy and the rest of the cast, it's amazing, and it really pops like it didn't back then.
That's very exciting.
Yeah, and Brent Marty, our musical director, has
who's
reinterpreted.
Always awesome. He's great.
He's amazing.
He's terrific, and he's reinterpreted some of the music, so it's got much more contemporary feel to it.
A little bit from the current Broadway revival.
He's, exactly.
Some of those feels to it too. Yeah.
But if you love the show,
yeah,
from past. You know, if you've seen it before, you're going to love the music. It'll just, you'll remember it all the way it was. And Judy sings an incredible Day by Day.
So in addition to Judy Fitzgerald, who else do we have in the cast that you can share with us?
Sure. Brandon Alstott is our Jesus. Matt Patterson is playing Judas. And in the rest of the ensemble is Claire Wiltshire, Paul Nicely, Tim Hunt, Lincoln Slentz, Mackenzie Travers, and Carol Worsell.
Right.
Excellent. Very good. Well, this is very exciting, and it's great to have you back and to direct this, and again to put a big musical in that space is a very exciting thing to do. I know that the audiences are just gonna love it. I want to turn this over for a minute here to James Riley, who's the new executive director of Actors Theater of Indiana. James, I just thought you were a guy from South Philly, right?
The Demarish guy from South Philly.
I would never say that. But you've been involved in different not-for-profits. Your work, of course, with the City Market. But you're not really a theater guy, right?
I'm not a theater guy at all. I think my role here is to pretty much run the organization like a business. I think from day one back in 2005, Judy and Don and Cindy, they did the shows. They did the fundraising. They did the marketing. They did the accounting. They did everything. I joke they probably even sold some wine and cheese in the lobby at the intermission too. But so I think my role here is simply to come in and run the business as a business and to free them up to do what they do best, and that's to entertain us.
Judy, is this an enormous relief for you?
I can't even begin to tell you. Jim is amazing, and I cannot get off this interview without mentioning Jessica White, who's just amazing and who has been an angel and actually stumbled on to Mr. Riley, didn't she?
I've got to say, my wife and I have been subscribers this year, and we've seen all the shows. And when you can leave a theater so excited and feeling so good about a show, that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
You've been truly entertained. And after the last show, Forbidden Broadway, my wife and I left and said, we got to find some way to help these people. They're just such a great organization, such great people. And I had since retired from the City Market, so about 2 weeks later I got a call. Suddenly my retirement's over and I'm back in the workplace at the Actors Theater. But I'm having a ball, and they're just great people to work with, and it's a great product. And it's been a lot of fun.
Judy, I have to ask you, and you and Don and Cindy founded this, this has been your passion for years. There's certainly always that that question of, you know, will you have founder syndrome or how can you give this up? I mean, what was it that led the three of you to decide, you know what, we need to put some of these operations in the hand of an executive director so, as Jim said, you can focus on, you know, making theater?
Well, one of the big things, first thing, we were all exhausted, and you start getting almost burnt out because you're doing the things that you don't do. You know, I'm running a box office, and then performing at night, and I would tell people that sometimes before a show they'd be like, "Are you nervous?" And I'd be like, "Heck no, are you kidding me? This is the only time I get to relax. I'm so excited. I'm, you know, but the big thing was is the cost of moving to the center really was monumental for us. It was huge, huge jump. And we knew that we needed to work on development for sure, and that's why Jessica White came into the picture, because she was...
And Jessica White and Associates is a local consultant.
And Jessica White and Associates, and she's
great group.
Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And so she started helping, and then things just... It's just bizarre how everything just fell into place and was right, but we knew we needed that, and then therefore she's like, okay, look, this is what you need to do. So I don't feel founder syndrome. I'm so happy.
It wasn't too hard to give up.
No, I'm so happy. I'm so happy that the center is running the box office and they're running everything, and we have a bookkeeper and we have interns and we're getting new office space where now our warehouse, everything is together in one spot, and it feels like we're just growing up.
Well, it's a big move. It's a big move for an organization. Congratulations on that. And Jim, I mean, it must be just kind of, I mean, you're smiling. It looks like you're having fun so far. It's still relatively new, but, you know.
Again, I'm having a ball, and I realized that they had a small problem when I started getting emails from Don at 3:30 and 3:45 in the morning.
Yeah.
So I realized then that they were being stretched pretty thin, and that if I can bring that kind of talent to the table to get them organized and again, just to free them up to do what they do best, and that's what I do, and that's what I enjoy doing.
Michael, you've been nodding through some of this. I would guess that you've had some experience on both sides of running a theater as well.
I haven't actually run a theater at all. I've helped a lot of companies do auditions and things in L.A., and obviously I've been acting for the last 20 years or so. But I was nodding mostly because having done Andrew's Brothers with Don last year, I would see him go out of rehearsal and immediately he's on his phone and he's having to deal with props and sets and designers and all of these other things.
Or fundraising or PR.
Or fundraising and PR.
Sure.
I mean, all of those things. And I know that Judy and Cindy are constantly behind the scenes doing that for that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, how do these three people pull this off? It's amazing to me that they've been able to do it. And I know that, you know, the shows for the last year, some of them have been really back to back, so they don't really get a break. And it's really wonderful for them, I know, because it's going to be great for them to be in the shows and to be really focused and not have to worry about all the other stuff.
So can you share with us a vision for where you see Actors Theater going over the next year or few years? I mean, whether it be specific shows or what you want to try to accomplish as you continue to grow.
Well, I'm not sure which one of us, if Mr. Old Jameson, like I like to call him, but should answer. But it's so exciting that we can actually plan, and we have people going. I would say with our board and everything, the way things were going, you know, we would, and we have a terrific board, and we have a brand new president, Nellie Mangus, who's amazing. But we would bring things in, and we could tell they were getting, you know, there's only so much, you know, when you keep saying you need money, you need money, you need. And now we have voices that can say to our board, hey, we want our first musical of our season that we want to do is enormous. It really is very big. I mean, we're of course shaving it down and making it work in the space, but that budget.
No, I'm sorry, you're talking about Godspell now.
Well, no, I'm going to tell you when we start our season, we don't announce. We can't announce that until February 14th. We're going to announce. We'll announce it, but the start of our season is we could have never done that without our new leadership and those folks telling our board, no, it is possible. We can do it. We can get these. We can do this, and so. I think that is kind of where I see us going now that we don't – I'm not saying that we're going to turn into doing a bunch of big musicals because that's not who we are, but we're getting to do what we want to do, not what we kind of have to do. You know what I mean?
And it seems like Godspell is an interesting choice and appropriate in many ways because it's a great sort of transition as you're going from, you know, what you've become to what you can be. And,
exactly.
Yeah, so congratulations. Exactly.
Travis DiNicola with ATI Artistic Director and cast member Judy Fitzgerald, ATI's new Executive Director James A. Riley, and Godspell Director Michael Dotson. The Actors Theater of Indiana's production of Godspell runs from February 10th through the 26th, and it's at the Studio Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. More information is available at actorstheaterofindiana.org, and that's theater with an R-E at the end, actorstheaterofindiana.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Eric Grayson of Indianapolis has done major restoration on Seven Chances, a 1925 Buster Keaton film. And he's receiving kudos across the film world for the incredible job he did to restore color. Yes, color to this rare film. It's two-color Technicolor that he restored over a period of 80 hours on 4,440 frames. Eric recently spoke with Sharon Gamble about early color in film and why it could be dangerous to projectionists.
You undertook a Herculean task, but I want you to give us the backstory. If you say color movies, most people think Gone with the Wind and later.
Yes.
How early was there color in film?
Well, if you really want to be picky, there was color going in film even at the very beginning. There was a Pathé stencil process that goes back to 1894, 1895.
No kidding.
Yeah. But Kinemacolor, which was the first process that recorded real color, was going by 1908, 1909, and worked pretty reliably. It was only two of the three primary colors.
Because?
Because they couldn't get the cameras to work fast enough to record red, green, and blue. They could only get red and green, and that was a problem for 20 years in color movies.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Was the photography industry, were the photography industry and the movie industry sharing their discoveries, and was there some overlap in?
There was a little bit of overlap. There wasn't a whole lot, because the nice part about regular photography is you could shoot color film, you could shoot color photos, not on color film, as early as the 1900s, you could use Maxwell's experiment. And Maxwell had a way that you could shoot red, green, and blue images on regular black and white film.
Huh.
And for a still photographer, that's fine, because he can just snap, put another filter on, snap, put another filter on, snap, put another filter on, and he's okay. You can't do that with motion pictures where you're doing 16, 18, 20 frames a second. That becomes a technical nightmare. So that was the difference between the still photographers and the regular photographers.
So of how many, if any, of these early experimental color films are extant? Are there any still around?
Oh, yeah. I've got a few reels of Kinemacolor stuff shot in New Jersey in 1908. The Gaumont Pathé process goes back 1909 to 1915 or so, and Eastman House has a few reels of that. And Technicolor's early stuff starts 1922, and they have material after that. It's kind of spotty. There's certainly not all the stuff exists that was made, but you can still find it.
Was it dramatically more expensive to shoot than black and white?
Yes. Technicolor, when it finally got its three-color cameras going, was actually three times as expensive just in film stock, because you were shooting a red, a green, and a blue piece of film. So just that in itself made it three times as expensive. But then you had to pay rental to Technicolor for the cameras and all kinds of stuff. So it was a lot more expensive, and very few people wanted to do it.
Sure. Now, it's one thing to know about the history of color film. It's another thing to actually restore a film.
Mm-hmm.
How did you learn to do this, and within in as much in layman's terms as you can describe to us?
Well, I sort of, as an independent consultant, I have to have many different lives. And one of the lives that I have is I'm also an electrical engineer. Mm-hmm. And I used to do forensics and signal processing. So I learned about how color signals fade and how they're balanced and how TV signals work and how that kind of thing goes. And so I was able to look at a faded Technicolor print from the 1920s, back when it did fade, and I was able to look at it and say, I think you could use some nonlinear color filtering on this and restore the color.
Hmm. How does that work?
Well, I actually took each individual frame, there were 4,000 frames, and I loaded them into Photoshop one at a time, and I adjusted them just the way you would adjust a color photo in Photoshop that was faded, and then I took it back out. So imagine how long that took.
I'm not sure when you slept because you were on a tight time frame.
I was on a tight time frame. It was over a weekend. I got it on Friday afternoon via FedEx, and they told me that I had to have it back by Monday morning.
How tell about the film and who wanted it restored?
Well, it was Kino Lorber, which is a big distributor of silent films and foreign films. They do a lot of really top quality stuff, and they had known that I had done some preliminary color work on this, so they contacted me. And they were, quite frankly, not sure that any color could be restored out of this. It was kind of a crapshoot for them. So I looked at it and I said, yeah, I think we can probably do this. And I just kind of worked on it very intensely over that weekend.
And this was a Buster Keaton film?
Yes, Seven Chances, 1925. In the early Technicolor process that they used, where the film was actually cemented together with glue, that was kind of nasty. It was acidic, and it made the prints fade over a period of time. So it was not really well made. Technicolor abandoned that, and they went to their dye transfer process just two or three years later. And that was what we remember Technicolor for today. It wasn't very good in the old days.
Mm-hmm. What replaced Technicolor? What technological advance came along that kind of bumped that out of the way?
Well, Kodak introduced Kodachrome in the mid-1930s, and it didn't quite do what they wanted. Everybody wanted a film that could be shot in a regular standard camera and could be processed easily like black and white could be. And Technicolor certainly wasn't that. It was very cumbersome. It required a 300-pound camera. And it required so much light that a lot of people had eye damage because of it.
Oh, my gosh.
The sets of Wizard of Oz were routinely over 100 degrees. So just imagine how uncomfortable it was shooting that.
Man.
Anyway, Eastman Color came in 1948, and that could be shot in a regular camera. It could be shot in a it could be processed in a regular tank, and it was pretty nice. The downfall of Eastman Color, unfortunately, is that it has a tendency to fade and turn red over a period of years, whereas Technicolor prints are stable and are almost archival quality.
That's something else I'm curious about. What do we know about the various eras of color and whether they will be stable for another 50 or 100 years?
Well, I could keep you going on that all day, and you'd want to shoot me after a few minutes. But Technicolor and Kodachrome are the most stable processes. Eastman Color, which is used in movies today, is pretty bad.
Really?
Since the 80s, it's been a little better. But the golden era of bad Eastman that was really fading was from about 1955 until about 1980. And you
That's
find
a big period.
Yes, it is. And you find a lot of films that have problems with their negatives and prints. For example, Star Wars needed a color restoration just a few years ago because the negative had faded on it to the point that they couldn't make good prints anymore. Whereas Gone with the Wind in Technicolor with the three black and white negatives, all you have to do is go back and reprint it, and you can still get a good print off of it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be doing a talk soon about the history of color in film. How did you decide that that was something there's a market for?
I don't think there's a market for anything I do, but I really enjoy doing it, so that's why I do it. That's a totally different question. But, I developed this because I thought it was interesting. People ask me about it all the time.
Sure.
And as a film collector, I'm always finding different film stocks and different ways that color was printed. And it's important for me to know which ones are the good ones and which ones aren't the good ones, because otherwise I may buy a print that looks good today, and in 6 months it's faded to the point where I can't use it.
Mm.
So I need to know that kind of thing. And since people were interested in it, I developed a show about it. And I used to do a lot of it on PowerPoint and overhead, and people got a little suspicious of it, because one of the things I do is I show Maxwell's experiment, where I have the red, green, and blue image. When I did that on PowerPoint, people said, oh, no, this is just some Photoshop tomfoolery, blah, blah, blah. Well, I actually got to the point where I got three real slide projectors with three real black and white slides, and I got people with color filters to hold them in front of the projectors.
Oh.
And then there's no way you can say that it's Photoshop.
It's no tomfoolery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Outside of your house, what is the biggest depository of film? Where is the big film archive in the world?
Well, there are a number of them. I would say Library of Congress is probably the largest one. We just worked with George Eastman House not long ago, and they did a bunch of stuff with the Gaumont chronochrome process. So they have a lot of that sort of thing. UCLA is another big one. And, of course, the one that everybody loves is the Czech Film Archive, because they have films that are on deposit there that have different reissue titles on them, and we find something new in there every year from 80 and 90 years ago that nobody knew was there.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
Remind us how you got hooked on films.
I got hooked on films because I was a little kid and I stayed up too late and watched Sammy Terry.
Sammy Terry, if you're listening, there
yes,
we go.
I got hooked on Sammy Terry years and years ago. And my parents were always annoyed with me because I was always staying up late and was useless on the weekends. So, yeah, that was kind of me. And then on Saturday nights, they had science fiction theater.
Oh, yeah.
And in the summertime, they had When Movies Were Movies and the Summer Film Festival. So a lot of times you just didn't see me until about noon or so. So it was a lot of fun for me.
And the first film you owned?
Ooh, I still have it. The first actual motion picture I owned on film is The Golem from 1920 with Paul Wegener. It's a German silent film.
Hmm. What's the most recent acquisition?
Recent as far as year or recent as far as when
coming
I found it?
Coming into your collection, when you found it.
I just got a Flip the Frog cartoon in two-color Technicolor from 1930. It was just on eBay, and that just arrived the other day. And I have a Max Davidson short. I love Max Davidson. He was a comedian in the late 1920s, and that showed up about the same time. It's hard to say which one was the most recent.
If you have films and you're thinking you need to get them into Eric's hands, stay tuned. We'll tell you how to check out his blog and get in touch with him.
Sharon Gamble with Eric Grayson on Friday, February 10th at 5:30. Eric will teach a 90-minute course on the history of color in film in the Toby at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. The class is free, but you do need to register. You can call 317-955-2339. Again, 317-955-2339. After Eric's talk, you can see The Quiet Man with John Wayne. Find out more about Eric Grayson and the world of movies at Eric's blog, drfilm.net, drfilm.net. Sharon.
Travis.
Have you gone on the zip line yet? Have you been to the Super Bowl Village? Have you participated in the human hamster wheel? I couldn't make this up, Sharon.
I did not know. How did I not know about the human hamster
wheel? Well, these are all things we're going to talk about in addition to all the other great arts and cultural activities going on this week on that calendar we call...
What do we do? The Zippy Edition.
There you go. There is actually a human hamster wheel that is part of the Super Bowl Village. And to be clear, the Super Bowl Village is the free part. That's all
right.
On Georgia Street. And it starts this weekend. And, of course, it goes through Sunday. And that's where the zip line rides are, as well as the huddle, the warming hut, lots of lights and pyrotechnics, the human hamster wheel super dash, ice sculpting, indie fringe fire performers, cheerleaders, and what I actually wanted to get to is a whole bunch of great concerts.
I was going to say, I know the bands are going to come up in there at some point.
Yeah,
but wait, I want to know, how does the human hamster wheel work?
Well, think about like what a big hamster wheel would look like, right?
Yeah.
And if you were a person inside, and what they have it lined with is with turf so that it's like you're running down like the AstroTurf of a football field, because all you would see would be the turf in front of you, but what you're actually doing is rolling the wheel down the street, apparently. Can't wait. That'll be interesting. If I don't make it back for next week's show, you'll know why.
I'll know what happened.
But, you know, but seriously, there are some great concerts going on pretty much, you know, I mean, every day, all day long. For Sunday, well, actually, if you're out and about either Friday night or Saturday during the day, on Saturday, it opens up with Orquesta Brava, which is such a really fun sort of like Cuban group. Later
very danceable.
Days, yeah, very danceable. Cynthia Lane's going to be performing great jazz. Jenny DeVoe at 8 o'clock on Saturday night at the Pepsi stage. And then Patti LaBelle at 9:15 on Saturday. And then on Sunday, there's a lot of cool stuff from Radio Disney and Junior Civic Theater earlier in the morning. And then later in the afternoon, you've got the Children's Choir, as well as a group called Kicking Daisies. And then it just really continues on every single day from now through Super Bowl. During the weekdays, performances start more around like 3:30 or so and go to about 9, and are just going to be a whole lot of fun. And then, of course, on things will really start ramping up as we get into Thursday, Friday, Saturday, with performances starting as early as 11:30 on those days.
And the great thing about the events starting so early is it gives you a chance to do a trial run. If you're planning on being downtown on Super Bowl Saturday or Sunday, it's a great way to maybe, weather permitting, bicycle down one of the trails, or maybe take the bus and just kind of
park and ride
or just kind of check things out. Hey, speaking of great concerts,
yes.
It is not too soon to think about Valentine's Day.
No, not at all. It's, what do you got in mind here?
You know, our colleague Stephen Stolen.
Oh, yes.
Probably hear him here on WFYI Radio. He's doing a Valentine's Day concert on behalf of the Cabaret at the Columbia Club. And he's got some wonderful songs in the playlist, including A Fine Romance, A Dream, A Little Dream, I Hate You, Darling, a wonderful wonderful story song, and, as they say, much more to come. You don't have to have a date, by the way. The Cabaret at the Columbia Club makes a special point of saying singles are welcome. So it might be your crowded room your eyes meet. I'm just saying. That is actually on February 14th at 8 o'clock at the Columbia Club. You can get more information by Googling Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
I do want to mention something about the Columbia Club. Shannon Forsell was on last weekend talking about their upcoming season. Since she was on one of the shows, the Pupini Sisters has been canceled, unfortunately, because of some issues with immigration and taxes and who knows what else. But sorry to hear that, but there'll be other great shows coming. If you already have tickets for that, then you can see about getting an exchange through the Cabaret. But no Pupini Sisters.
Oh, I know. But so many more fabulous things to see. That what a strong season. All sorts of great things. Hey, speaking of music and romance, Company, the great Sondheim piece that was one of the first to put him on the map, I think it's safe to say. It's set in 1970. Carmel Community Players is doing a production right now through February 4th. And it's the story of Bobby, a single man of a certain age who is unable to commit to a steady relationship. And he's surrounded by all sorts of loving couples who are his friends and who keep encouraging him to try to find love. I won't tell you how it comes out, but you can find out more and see that at Carmel Community Playhouse, which is up at Clay Terrace.
Very good. Hey, something else sort of Super Bowl related, and that is taking place at the President Benjamin Harrison home, and that is the special football-themed exhibit Presidential Huddle, which showcases football-related artifacts and pictures of Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, Teddy Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, Dwight Eisenhower, Nixon, Kennedy, and all other commanders-in-chief and their connections with football. The Presidential Huddle is included with the price of admission to the President Benjamin Harrison home and is open through Monday, February 13th.
Speaking of football, there are cheerleaders in this musical performance. They're naughty, not as naughty as they were in the film. Debbie Does Dallas on stage at the... You knew where I was going with
I
that.
Did.
At Theater on the Square.
Where through... musical numbers appropriately replace the other... original
absolutely
numbers.
Absolutely. And it's relatively tame for what it is. Debbie Does Dallas at Theater on the Square. Information at tots.org. I'm just saying.
I'm glad you are. Hey, Book Mamas, which is that great, fun little used and sometimes new bookstore out in Irvington, has a lot of great February events coming up to put on your calendar. Lots of different readings as well as performances out there going on pretty much almost every Friday, Saturday, or Sunday that happens out of Book Mamas in Irvington, right across from Lazy Days Cafe. Also, they have started a whole bunch of new book clubs. If you've ever wanted to get into a book club, then they have a number of literary ladies that meet each month, as well as shared pages and other different titles of book clubs. If you're looking to join one, check out Book Mamas in Irvington.
What do they call it if it's a guys' book club?
Groovy guys, I'm sure.
Page turning pals, something like that. I'm sorry, Kathleen. I won't say it again. I don't know how to connect this to the Super Bowl. Well, I can think of a way, but it's okay. Sometimes people have a certain beverage during football games, whether they're watching them on TV or maybe they're attending.
Hot tea, perhaps?
Probably something a bit stronger. Yeah. There is a fabulous show that's being produced. This is a little bit of a road trip. Cardinal Stage Company is going to put on, you know where I'm going now, don't you? Bill W. and Dr. Bob. It is the story of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it is a stage version of a true story, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's been produced in Indianapolis. Tots did a production of it a few years ago. But if you haven't had a chance to see it or you want to see it again, you can go see Cardinal Stage Company's production, which opens on February 2nd and runs through about two-thirds of February.
Very cool. Hey, if you are looking for something to do next weekend and you want to avoid the traffic downtown, because there will be a lot.
What? There's going to be traffic downtown?
Especially like I'm thinking on, on Saturday when the Reverend Payton's Big Damn Band, great local band, is playing at 2 o'clock on Saturday next week downtown. Well, anyways, but if you want to check out something totally different, check out the World Party, which is an international marketplace super celebrations that is taking place up at the Service Center for Culture and Community. That's Big Car's new endeavor out at Lafayette Road, as part of the whole Lafayette Square area. And they are hosting three nights of cultural parties and celebrations with authentic international music, dancing, food, drink, art, local and international beers and wines. And all these celebrations are benefiting the Lafayette Square Area Coalition and Big Car, with a lot of cool people coming together with music curated by DJ Kyle Long in partnership with the Cultural Cannibals, which should be just a whole bunch of fun. Thursday night, they celebrate the Americas with a focus on Central and South. Friday, Africa, and Saturday, Asia and India. You can get more information at bigcar.org about all of this. It should be a ton of fun. A super celebration.
Super celebration. Excellent. Hey, you know what? At some point, the Super Bowl is going to be over, and you're going to have more time on your hands.
That's right.
I'm just saying.
And we'll be back next week with more things to do after the game is over on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Artist Justin Vining started out as an attorney, but now he's pursuing a career as a painter. His work features whimsical houses and landscapes, often painted on recovered wood from whimsical houses and landscapes. Travis DiNicola spoke to Justin about his upcoming show of work at Upland Brewing Space in the Murphy Arts Building, and he also spoke with Jason Cooper from Upland Brewing about the Upland Propaganda Room.
Jason, I'm going to start with you, because this is a pretty cool thing that Upland does, has been doing for a while with First Fridays at your space down at the Murphy Arts Building. Tell me sort of about the parties that you guys throw once a month that connect with artists and local nonprofits and good local beer.
that's most important for us, at least. Well, we are always trying to think of creative ways to get our beer in people's hands. We ended up moving this summer into the Murphy Building. It's just our office space. It's just like a good space to store things and have the occasional meeting. Mm-hmm. But it's such a great space, and they already had a great First Friday event that we knew we wanted to be a part of that.
Sure.
So we get a different artist every month to come in and show their work for that night. And then if there's anything else going on throughout the month, we're happy to have that art still hang up on the walls. But we get a different artist in each month to show their work. We have a different not-for-profit that we team up with every month as well.
Okay.
And then we also have a great friend of ours, a DJ in town named Jack Ola, who's playing some music. And then we sell our beer for very low prices. And then we give the proceeds of the beer of the sales that night to the not-for-profit that's
awesome.
Helping out.
So promoting the not-for-profit, promoting the local artists, connecting it all. Just adding another cool element down in Fountain Square.
That's the idea. Absolutely.
Cool. That's a really very cool thing. And I was delighted to see that Justin was going to be featured for February. Justin, I've been wanting to get you on the show. I met you a couple months back. In fact, when you were showing your art as part of a big event for the Indiana Recycling Coalition. And in fact, it's the Recycling Coalition that's, again, benefiting from the show you're doing coming up, right?
That is correct. I thought that would be a great way to... give back. I was honored to display my work at their event, and it just seemed like a small way that I could say thank you.
Well, I was really excited about your work that I saw that night and what I've seen since. It's really sort of this interesting kind of these whimsical, not quite cartoonish, but very just fun buildings and landscapes. And one of the things I really enjoy about the work that you're painting is that you're using often as your canvas, like sort of recycled wood from, you know, old houses or furniture or things you found. I mean, that's a really sort of neat element to it, because you've got these like great, clean, modern lines on one hand with your painting, but then this sort of, you know, old, weathered wood that's your canvas.
Yeah, I really like to embrace the found objects in my work. And a lot of times I feel some of the advantages in working with a found object is it's one of a kind before I even touch it.
Yeah.
So I can just exploit what's already there and bring out the natural beauty and do a little bit of painting, maybe paint a nice little house or a barn, and bring it to life. So
it looks to me, I mean, like a lot of the stuff you're painting, it looks like it's got to come from just great memories you have of houses or farms or landscapes.
Yeah, my background, I did grow up on a farm, and I'm naturally drawn to paint that subject, and I can't get away from it. So.
It's just a real positive sense of home, you know, and that I really enjoy in your work. And one thing I found really interesting about you, you actually, you know, are an attorney as well, right?
I am, and I do practice a little bit.
You do
right
practice?
Now. Yeah,
okay.
I do. I have a small caseload on the side. It's fun practicing law. It's a little bit scary at times as a young independent attorney, but
See, most people would switch that and say, like, you know, the law, you know, being a professional artist is the scary part.
No, I think that that just sort of seems natural.
Yeah. So how does that all work together? I mean, it's an interesting combination, because, I mean, two totally different parts of your brain you're using, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't think about the differences that much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just seems to balance. I don't really know how to describe it any other way, but
different ways of solving problems.
Yeah,
and stuff.
It really is, and I enjoy the practice of law, but I honestly enjoy painting more.
Tell me about your art training. How'd you get involved in doing what you're doing?
My background.
You've got such a specific style. I mean, it's so recognizable.
Yeah, I guess just to give you a little bit of context, my background in high school, I was always interested in art, but looking back, I wouldn't have called myself that kid in the art class that was really good at painting or drawing. Rather, I just had the passion. And when I went to Purdue, I decided to follow that passion and become an art teacher. I taught elementary art on the northeast side of Indy for 3 years, and it really was an awesome job. Loved it.
Okay.
But my younger brother decided he was going to go to law school, and long story short, I went with him. And it really wasn't until I was in law school that I found my artistic voice. I mean, I painted, I would consider myself more of a hobbyist before law school. I mean, I painted for fun, I never really had this ambition of becoming a full-time professional artist. But I found my artistic voice. I was in school with a bunch of incredibly intelligent peers that happened to have their MBAs and taught me how to build the business side of creating. And by the time I graduated law school, we had built a sustainable business with a sustainable income. And I've just continued to chase it, and I continue to paint full time.
So let's talk about this voice that you're talking about, because, you know, I think one of the absolute hardest things for an artist to do is to find that specific voice, that style, that is them, that's recognizable when you see a work and you say, oh, you know, that's a Justin Vining, or you know, locally a lot of other, you know, some artists have some really, you know, noticeable, recognizable styles, whether it's like Emma Overman or Kyle Ragsdale or, you know, whoever,
right,
you might, you know, picking stuff. And your style, if you can you describe to me, I mean, maybe the work you were doing before you found your voice and how it sort of transitioned? I mean, can you think back to that?
Yeah, and I guess there is another even, I'll describe that, and there is an almost a question before that too that I'll answer as well. And in regards to my style, sort of that distinctness, I actually had somebody write me this week on the internet asking the very same question.
Yeah.
And what I responded, I worry less about the style or creating a specific type of work, and I just paint what I'm passionate about.
Okay.
And that painting what I'm passionate about, the consistency, it's almost the style continues to evolve, but has evolved over time into what you see today. So I think when you see that style or say that style, it's I would almost say it's more passion.
Okay, so you're not like consciously trying to create this style.
No.
It's just you're painting what you're passionate about, and this is the style you found that that comes out. But
right now, to follow that up, and actually my digression, can you?
Well, you know, in terms of what was your work like sort of before you found that voice?
Yeah, okay, similar.
Okay.
After high school, through my undergrad at Purdue, I was painting rural landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
I would say they were more traditional.
Okay.
More impressionistic. I would say more what you would think of when you see, when I would say Indiana rural barn painting,
sure,
or landscape painting. What you're picturing in your mind was probably more like what I was painting then.
Yeah.
And in the years, it has continued to evolve, painting the farms, but I've simplified it, cleaned it all up.
Very clean lines.
Right. I really like those sharp edges.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just... it's been a continuous evolution over time, but
And then adding in that element of the found object, is that something more recent?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
That happened. I was at a garage sale while I was in law school. There was this guy. He had like 10 table leaves, all beautiful walnut, oaks, and I think they were $1 a piece. And they're just beautiful. And I was like, I have got to do something with these things. So I bought them all. They were in my garage for about a year. And I was getting ready for my first solo show. And I was like, I think it's time to do something with these pieces.
Yeah.
I had this one in particular that had really beautiful grain. And I set it aside. And I had it in my living room, not in the garage, for that year. And one random day before that show, I picked it up. I painted a cool little house on it. I just let the grain sort of speak for itself. The grain looked like fields already. I exploited it just a bit with transparent acrylics, just enough to bring out the beauty.
Okay.
And I was hooked. I started painting on all sorts of found objects. And some of the pieces you saw at the IRC banquet.
Yes.
Some of those actually just came from alleys in Indianapolis. I mean, old shutters, all sorts of stuff that I've just sort of found around the area. And I think it's fun to take that, you know, what's already there and, again, exploit it.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, can you share with us a preview of any of the work, maybe some new work that's going to be at the Upland show?
Yeah, actually, obviously the show is less than 2 weeks away, so I'm pretty knee deep in all these paintings. I've started all the major works for the show, and a lot of it is on plywood, actually. So not found object, you know, plywood I've bought, but it's sort of taking that found object to sort of one step, maybe it's not a step further, but something like that. And I'm doing a lot of black and white work, and white acrylic, really dense, opaque cityscapes.
Yeah, the poster for this, I mean, features obviously like an, you know, Indianapolis cityscape.
Right, and the objective, my objective for painting on the plywood is the contrast between the wood grain, the natural color of the wood, and just sort of these cityscapes that, I mean, they almost look like they don't belong on this plywood.
Mm-hmm.
They look, it's sort of taking those clean lines, the defined edges, and really trying to challenge myself, take it a step further, and there's really no room for error, because if I get paint outside on this plywood anywhere else outside these cityscapes, it you know, kind of ruins the effect.
Well, it's interesting with these tight sort of illustrative lines. I mean, and you see the cityscape and you're thinking, you know, metal and glass and concrete, and yet it's existing on a piece of wood, which is, you know, totally opposite of what you're thinking for the cityscape. I mean,
right.
It's kind of an interesting combination.
It
of
is.
Sense and of material.
It's been really fun to paint on, and yeah, it's definitely different. I don't think I've really seen anything like it. So it's a lot of pieces like that. I also, along with these pieces on plywood, I'm doing some mixed media pieces. One of the things I've done post-law school is I've taken all of the materials that I used or you know, my notes, the textbooks, all this stuff. I'm putting it all back into my art. So one of the biggest pieces, it's 4 feet by 5 feet. It has the last 200 pages of, actually, it's my brother's civil procedure book in it.
Literally.
I use the pages. Yeah, it's funny because the first 700 pages are now hanging in the Valparaiso School of Law as a piece of art we donated back to the school. So
that's awesome.
The last 200 pages are going to be a part of this show. And again, it is going to be a cityscape. And I think this one's going to be Indianapolis.
Jason, I want to give you the last word on this. Do you have a recommendation for a particularly good upland beer that would go well with Justin's work here?
I would stick with our Dragonfly IPA, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something about that that has enough substance to it that's really going to hold
bite,
up for the night. It's
got a sort of mix of different flavors going
on
in a way.
But I will say that I think any of it goes pretty well with it just because... I know our logo is not all that dissimilar from a lot of Justin's work, and I think he's had people ask him if he's worked with us in the past. So
I have.
I think any of our stuff will go just fine with Justin's work.
Travis DiNicola with artist Justin Vining and Upland Brewing's Jason Cooper. A show of Justin's work will take place from 6 to 9 on Friday, February 3rd, in the Upland Brewing space, which is called the Upland Propaganda Room, in the Murphy Art Building in Fountain Square. There'll be music from DJ Jackola, and all beer proceeds will benefit the Indiana Recycling Coalition. More information is available at justinvining.com. That's J-U-S-T-I-N-V-I-N-I-N-G, justinvining.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios. At owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 when, in recognition of that little game, the Super Bowl, I get a preview of the Jim Irsay collection being exhibited right now at the Indiana State Museum.
And then I'll get to sit down and chat with performer, comedian, writer, commentator, and fringer, Phil Van Hest, also known as Phil the Void. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.